Hi everyone, this is Chris Phillips, the founder and executive director of Democracy Cafe, dedicated to making knowledge a world in which people are more thoughtful, reasonable, connected, even empathic. Our website, democracycafe.org, if you go to the drop-down menu, you see that we have hundreds of ongoing groups around the globe, from Mumbai to Minneapolis to Portland to Northern California to Tokyo. My guest today is David Palumbo Liu, professor at Stanford University. David, thanks so much for being on our podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
David, I wrote to you after being very moved by a piece that you published recently in The Guardian, less than a week ago, or exactly a week ago, I think it was. And I'm just going to read the opening two sentences where you write, "Today, anyone can be accused of anything without basis in fact or evidence. And that accusation can be instantly trumpeted over the airwaves unchecked by any journalistic standard. That is the painful lesson I have had to learn this year. As a scholar activist working on issues such as sexual assault, Palestine, anti-fascism, I am used to receiving abusive messages and being publicly maligned. Now, however, attacks on me have reached troubling new heights." You're a professor at Stanford. You've been teaching for over a quarter of a century. What happened?
Well, what happened was that a campus newspaper here asked to interview me about an organization that I helped start. And I said, well, there are a couple of already existing really good stories out on the web. Why don't you consult them first? And then if you have further questions, I'd be happy to answer them. And so the editor got back to me and she said, well, I appreciate the two articles. I have a few questions that I'd like to ask you nonetheless. And I said, sure, let's just do it by email. It's easier that way. And one of the things that so the group basically is called the Campus Anti-Fascist Network. Mm-hmm. And we were founded to really help educate and prepare university communities for the intrusions of fairly aggressive alt-right organizations. Mm-hmm. And we were concerned about public safety above all else. Mm-hmm. And she said, yes, but isn't Antifa associated with violence? And I said, well, as the term is understood now, and especially in common parlance, yes, but we make a distinction between, self-defense and initiating violence. And we certainly do not promote initiating violence in any way, shape, or form. On the other hand, if there's a threat, then we should be able to know how to defend ourselves and also work with the university security forces to do this. And she came back and repeated the question and said, what do you mean by self-defense? And I said, that's a great question. This would also include things like being harassed on the web, et cetera. And so she said, thank you very much, and I'll send you the link when it comes out. And so I said, great. Everything was cordial and professional. And then she sent me the link and I clicked on it. And the headline was something to the effect of Antifa thugs find leader and promoter in Stanford professor. Mm-hmm. And the piece was just filled with innuendo. Mm-hmm. They quoted me very, very briefly and out of context, and then said, well, no matter what he says, he's undeniably part of a terrorist organization. And I said, oh boy, this is really beyond the pale. But I sort of, I wrote a response because I thought this would be an interesting learning experience in terms of not just myself, obviously, but for people to come. And then it just amplified because it got picked up on the national media. And this one individual appeared on Fox and Friends, and she doubled down. And what was really, an indication of how things were going off the rails was Fox and Friends began the segment by saying, Stanford professor starts Stanford University Club to fight fascism. And that's simply not true. I mean, that's a blatant untruth. There's no university club along with, the Glee Club and everything right. else fighting fascism. And so, and from then on, it just was more and more innuendo. And as I said in the piece in The Guardian, I'm of the generation that does remember, not so long before we were young people, McCarthyism. And right. this is classic McCarthyism. But the difference that I point out in my article is that in McCarthyism, at least it was confined to, what was then called the mainstream press. But when you have the internet and social media as being instantly accessible and usable to spread these kinds of, frankly, lies, it's
right.
troubling, especially when it's an accusation about terrorism, which we're all concerned about, obviously. And what was finally the most important rebuttal to it was that six law professors at Stanford Law, all specialists in constitutional law, mm-hmm. and coming from a wide range of political viewpoints, from liberal to conservative, all signed a letter saying there's absolutely no evidence in the public record mm-hmm. that David Polumbo Liu has ever has ever promoted violence or is a member of a terrorist organization. There's no basis in fact. And yet it's out there, and death threats are coming in, et cetera, et cetera.
You are getting death threats.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And so, you know, I one of the thoughts when I first read it that came to my mind was, what if this kind of social media had been available in the days of McCarthyism? Would yeah. we even be would we still even have any semblance of an open society today?
Yeah. No, it is troubling, and especially when you see the erosion of all the kinds of checks and balances that we rely on to keep our society in equilibrium. And when you have, you know, a national leader saying fake news is everything and, mm-hmm. you know, is all over and nobody's to be trusted, then that's mm-hmm. that completely undermines any kind of foundation in mm-hmm. Just a rational discussion, as your radio program is trying to present a rational discussion about what's going on.
Right. I mean, that's what Hitler did. I mean, and he used mechanisms, democratic mechanisms, to subvert an open society, and part of that is to attack the free press.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm all for critiquing the media. I think that we should all be, you know, ready to really scrutinize the information we're receiving and triple check our sources. And unfortunately, so much of that burden now falls on the everyday person, right? It used to be that you'd have investigative journalists, you'd have a very robust conversation going on. And now it falls upon us to be our own investigative journalists. And many of us don't have the time and resources, but you're exactly right.
Well, I remember even when Wikipedia started. And first person out of the starting gate who decided to write something about me had an agenda, and he did not like what I do. And once that first person puts something, you go through this Kafka-esque process to try to, this idea that it's somehow open, access, and objective. It was ludicrous. It took me a year's worth of great stress to set the record straight. But once somebody has an agenda, it's really Kafka-esque.
And that's exactly the word I would use. And the problem is that, again, in this climate, it's so intensely polarized. So agendas tend to be more extreme and more vociferous and more amplified. Mm-hmm. And then they take on a life of their own. And any sort of, you know, again, balanced discussion about what is actually going on mm-hmm. is completely lost in the static.
So, you know, I mean, if it wasn't so serious what you're experiencing, you know, it would be laughable. It's just such a rabbit hole. But what do you do?
Yeah. Well, that's exactly the question. And what I pointed out in my Guardian essay is that I'm speaking purely from the point of view of somebody who mm-hmm. works in the academy. Mm-hmm. You know, the academy is a very important place. This is mm-hmm. where ideas are tested. You know, mm-hmm. we're supposed to have a free and open debate about things. Mm-hmm. And I think that the difficulty now is that college administrators don't understand the new terrain that we're operating on, the one that you and I just talked about, right? They still go back to basic principles of free mm-hmm. speech, which are very important, mm-hmm. but they don't understand that a lot of these events that are going on campus have nothing to do with free speech, which is, after all, meant to increase knowledge, increase the veracity of what we understand to be true. Mm-hmm. No, they're there for basically self-promotion, as you say. They have agendas, and they're using university spaces simply to be kind of staging grounds for theatrics. I mean, Milos is probably the worst case of this, but university administrators really have to understand this is a whole new world, and it's good to have bedrock values, but we have to adapt them to current realities. For example, several students at Stanford were concerned about Robert Spencer being invited to campus. And so they, you know, they were talking on their private social media, and somehow they got Robert Spencer got a hold of it. And all of a sudden their photos were on Jihad Watch and they were labeled Stanford fascists, again, without any basis in fact. But it takes on this whole new life, which, again, campus administrators really have to understand the new playing field.
How do you make them understand that?
I don't know. You see, I've been trying to. And you know, the main thing of, and this is not just universities, but I think, right, you know, most institutions, you know, they're conservative. They want to maintain equilibrium, you know, and that's good.
Right.
But there's a new, there are new dangers being presented, and certainly since Charlottesville. And even the ACLU has begun to revisit its basic principles, which I think is important, because it's a whole new set of actors with different agendas, and the instruments that we've been talking about. Most of anti-fascist work takes place on the internet. In other words, one looks at hate group sites and understands the chatter and the way they're organizing. And this is really an important mode. And a lot of these hate groups actually have been bumped off the internet proper, and they've started their own internet because they have not been allowed space because they are precisely so hateful and promoting violence. And that's the other thing that we have to understand, is that, you know, free speech is a very capacious idea, but in the famous Brandenburg v. Ohio case, the Supreme Court said any speech that is launched to incite violence, that has the likelihood of producing violence, is not protected under free speech. And we're getting more and more of that kind of speech coming out into the public sphere.
And yet, when, you know, the person elected president of the United States, and I don't believe we had really good choices in the major corporate-driven parties, but you have somebody who betrays the tendencies of at minimum, a malignant narcissist. I mean, what, again, I you know, I became a dad late in life. I have a 4-year-old and 11-year-old, and I'm fretting.
Exactly.
What do I do?
I know that's I was just talking to some sophomores here at Stanford, and their first year of college was, you know, was marked by the election of Donald Trump, and the shock waves just were tremendous, because they were hopeful and energetic and full of optimism, and then all of a sudden, the new world that they are going to live in for the next 4 years or so, and that's going to be fundamental to their growth as young adults, has been taken over, almost hijacked, by somebody who doesn't play by the rules and who is not cautious and who is, as you say, incredibly narcissistic, and everything, you know, becomes filtered through his sense of how people are, you know, in favor or, in, you know, against him. I mean, the notion that the Democrats that didn't applaud the State of the Union were traitors. This is, but then again, this brings out the worst element in so many people. And then, as I've said, you know, when they come out and they're very vociferous and amplified, it unfortunately brings to many of us to think, so, well, we have to be exactly as aggressive as they are. And then pretty soon the thought of having a decent conversation is completely obliterated. So in terms of what one does, that's a great puzzle.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, as you can probably tell from my Tidewater twang, I'm a Virginian. I started out at University of Virginia, and then I transferred to William & Mary to study this thing called liberal arts. Fairly conservative campus, but I had great profs who really opened up my mind to developing tools to think for myself. And I remained eternally grateful to them for that, and have thanked them and acknowledged them in my books. But I wonder now if we're bereft of that element. I held a dialogue in Charlottesville after the horrific violence there. And but this notion, don't you have to at some point, you know, stand up for yourself if you are attacked.
I think the other problem is, again, looking at current realities, is the speed with which all this happens. Because then, you know, speed acts against deliberation. And you feel like you have to be reactive to somebody who's spewing out things every millisecond. And so the whole climate has become toxic, and
it's dizzying. I try to focus on what my nonprofit initiative is about. We have these dialogue groups. We never know who's going to come, but I'm actually finding it more challenging than ever. Much as I would, you know, I do everything out of sort of optimistic lenses, but it's. I wonder and worry about where our democracy, such as it is. Might be 10 years from now.
No, that's a great question. It's there are so many pre-existing problems with our political system that I remember there was a large meeting of faculty at Stanford after the election, and a lot of the faculty were scientists. I mean, they weren't, you know, political radicals by any sort or humanists. They were they were really concerned about the attack on science and knowledge and the idea that, you know, the there are certain forbidden words now that you can't use. This is incredible. And so many of us were saying, "Oh, we're already waxing nostalgic for the old days." Mm. You know, when you just had, you know, clear set ideologies, you had it out, but there was a basis in rational discussion, even though, you know, there was certainly animosity and whatnot. Mm. But that's the thing that actually is really important to foreground is that. Many of my colleagues said, well, you know, if it was just confined to the United States, that would be one thing. We're responsible for our elective system and all that. But think of the implications of what is happening for climate change, for example, science in general. It's global. And this is what, you know, what increases the urgency behind what we do. And yet it seems like all the checks and balances, again, are faulty at this point.
So checks and balances. Tell me more about that. The crumbling of checks and balances.
Well, I mean everything from, for example, the State Department is still. I mean, so many positions are not filled. So we don't really have a diplomatic core that is able to negotiate our position in the world. We have a judicial system that's under attack with the president calling judges fake judges. So, so if you just go through the Congress, the judiciary, the executive branch, and then go back to the bedrock notions of the Constitution, they're all being interpreted in very broad ways. And again, very politicized ways. Things as simple as tax reform or healthcare, all these things have gone way beyond the spectrum of what we were used to thinking would be acceptable variants, so that it's become predatory, frankly.
But where are the statesmen and stateswomen? I remember when people tried to vilify Obama and John McCain stood up for him in the presidential campaign. Right. The guy wanted to win, but he wouldn't win at the expense of that kind of demonization vilification. Where are the people with backbone who are in a position to arrest this pernicious development?
This is what's been puzzling, because you've had various members of Congress on both sides of the aisle coming out sharply criticizing various initiatives that the president has sponsored or has supported, and yet they vote with him. So it's a puzzle to me that there's so much, you know, corruption would be one word, but I think it's broader than that. It's just a sense of, let me put it this way. My belief is that most politicians are self-interested, and they think that their self-interest insofar as it reflects the interests of their constituency is positive, but at a certain point, they're basically trying to perpetuate their presence for as long as possible. Right. But it's gotten to be the case that it's gone way beyond party allegiances, and it's gotten to be, you know, as I've said, you know, in my organization, it's gotten close to fascism, which is that there's a particular superior group, whether it be racially determined or gender or whatever, but they are in place, and they're the people that count, and this is the 1%. So this is what's really disturbing to me, is that both Democrats and Republicans, maybe more so on one side than the other, but they're still protecting the most protected people, which is ironic, and throwing all the rest of us under the bus, we don't have a political voice. Yeah.
Well, you have hit the nail on the head. They are the people who count. That, you know, there was a Princeton study about the fact that those at the upper 5% of the economic echelon are the only ones whose voices are heeded and heard.
Yeah.
And that 95%, regardless of their political views, are completely discounted. So we don't have anything remotely resembling sensible gun laws. We don't have anything really. I mean, there's most people even support things like attempting universal basic income, but we can't even try that because of the way that the system is organized right now. And so, I mean, I've watched some of your YouTube presentations. You talk about, there's a veneer of harmony, but that we can still sort of strive, and that there's extremes on all sides, and that we nonetheless might strive for common cause. But how do you do that when those who are in elective office are principal roadblocks to that?
Well, again, because I'm a professor of literature and I care about language, I'm just thinking about I think Bernie Sanders had a few town halls, and he talked to various Trump supporters, and he basically just listened to them, and he said, "Well, are you for this, this, and this?" And without associating it with one party or the other, and he said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, then why did you vote for Trump? Because he's against all those things." But it's just this: the dominant voices are so loud that exactly things like gun control or living wage or all sorts of things that most people on both sides of the well both parties
They
would
do.
be for because it's good,
That's right.
but it's been hijacked into political parties, and the Democrats, sad to say that they've really lost they've lost touch with their progressive, history, and they've become more and more. They're trying to out-Republicanize the Republicans, and this is where we are now is because the Democrats don't have any counterbalance on a progressive side
So
within the
I
party.
yes, and so I asked myself, given these circumstances, I mean, is it what can we the people do? I mean, I can model thoughtful listening. I know you stress the importance of thoughtful, really, really genuine listening. But in once you get caught in this kind of rabbit hole that you are, there's things at stake that, sort of derail you. And they're deliberately trying to derail you.
Well, I'm thinking about the wonderfully uplifting women's marches that showed, graphically how much support there is. The question is, how do you harness all that energy, especially when it's been sapped over and over again by, playing defense? We have to have a way to consolidate the leadership that produced that march with other leaders that, and it's going to be difficult because, there are obviously differences in different priorities, but we have to be able to agree on a common base. And I don't see that emerging, and that's what's really frightening. I think a lot of people are waiting for the midterm elections to see what states or districts might flip. But again, I'm worried about taking false hope in that because let's say that more Democrats get elected, but what positions will those Democrats actually advocate for? That's the question that's more important.
Absolutely. David, where did you where did your love of scholarship and community engaged learning, where did that come from? Was it something that you learned from in your youth or what?
Well, I think that maybe most basically, so my mother came to this country in the early 1930s, and she had a very interesting career, and she actually became, part of the Eleanor Roosevelt circle, and so
Is that
she's a
right?
staunch, yeah, she was a staunch, Democrat, and really, thought about progressive things, etc. And she got a degree at Radcliffe in Romance Languages, and so she. That side of her I have, I suppose, but I think that really the fact that I grew up in the East Bay and I went to Berkeley during a time when all these things were part of what everybody was talking about, and so they became part of my understanding of what the university was about, and then I sort of took that into my own teaching. So that's been all very good, and I know that it's very interesting to see how one is affected in different ways given one's environment. So you grew up in Virginia then,
I
or?
grew up in Virginia, and yet I lived, when I first started my Socrates Cafe, I lived in the Bay Area. I started at a place called Mad Magna's Russian Tea Room. Yeah, it's no longer there. It was a beautiful place to start. But and you know, you we and even then though, I was discovering, people across the political spectrum can be quite can consider themselves open-minded and yet can be very orthodox and closed in opinion. That was 20 years ago.
Yeah. Now, I think the real struggle would be to come up with a new political vocabulary.
Because
the one that we have now is so polarizing that, again, unless you have the time and patience to, you know, come back into conversation with people over and over again, you know, it's too inflammatory. So that would be one thing. But I think that we're caught in a very difficult time where we feel like we have to react quickly because so much is going down so quickly. But in terms of building true resistance, it's going to take time and it's going to take patience. Yeah.
It's going to take time at a time when people want instantaneous solutions. I love this notion of building a new political vocabulary, recognizing that words matter and count, that they determine our language and conduct and the way that we interact with one another.
Right, exactly.
Do you have any more like specific notions of what that might look like?
I think it might be useful to begin with, to re-examine the roots of certain words like liberalism and things like that, and what do they actually stand for, and how they contain the possibility for self-critique. And I think that's really essential for us to understand that that language is something that we take responsibility for. Toni Morrison, I always advise people to listen or to read her Nobel Prize acceptance speech. She has a beautiful speech that talks about, you know, language is a responsibility and we have to keep it healthy. And if we don't, you know, our society suffers. So I think just paying attention to what we're saying. And I one of the courses I teach at Stanford that I enjoy the most is a composition course. And a lot of my colleagues think of that as too basic, nuts and bolts and beneath them. But, you know, what I enjoy about it is that all sorts of students from across the various disciplines take the course. And I say, you know, this is a tool. This is an empowering tool to be able to speak well and to be able to understand language and to defend yourself. So I think just paying attention to what we're saying and being patient with ourselves and with others to find out what we're really agreeing on or not agreeing on and the consequences of those.
David Palumbo-Liu, thank you so much for being on the Democracy Cafe podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and I enjoy your show, and I'll look forward to hearing more episodes.